Welcome to the Art of Healthcare podcast, where we aim to be as good at the human side of healthcare as we are at the clinical side of healthcare. My name is Chris Desmond. I'm a physiotherapist who's fascinated by how we can better help the person with the problem. Join us as we learn how to connect better, how to show up better, and how to understand our patients and ourselves better. Welcome to the Art of Healthcare podcast. This is where we get to explore the human skills of healthcare so we can better help the person with the problem. Today, I am joined by Dr. Laura Rock. I've been excited about this conversation for a little while, ever since Nick Hannah shared a post on Instagram about not answering feelings with facts. So Laura, welcome so much. That's really poor communication to start things off. It's 5 o'clock here in the morning. So welcome to the Art of Healthcare show.
Well, thank you for accommodating my time zone. And I'm happy to be here.
Actually, you're accommodating me because as a stay-at-home dad at the moment, 5 o'clock is kind of a good time for me because the kids aren't awake just yet. Laura, I always like to kick things off just by asking, why do you care about the art of healthcare? Why do you care about the human side of healthcare? It's a loaded question.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, almost all of us has experienced being a patient or a family member of a patient. So it's easy to see it from that perspective and wanting to be treated as an individual and having a physician or a nurse or physical therapist or any clinician really care about me as a person and not just the problem that I have. And it feels so different when I'm really seen as a person. But I really got interested initially as a clinician because I felt that no matter how smart I think I am, or no matter how much I study, and no matter how much science I know about a problem, if I don't have trust with the person I'm trying to help, and I can't speak in a way that works for them and help them know how much I care, then all of that other work and knowledge is really not going to be effective.
When did you come to that realization?
That's so funny. I don't know if I've ever thought about that. Well, I was really drawn to the complex conversations and kind of high stakes environment of critical care, which is my clinical specialty, during my residency. And I also was very influenced by my mother having a lot of medical problems throughout my training. So I really remember when I was a resident, which I think you call it something else in New Zealand, but when I was in my training after medical school, during my specialty training, my mother had multiple cancers. I can't actually remember which one it was at the time, but she was waiting for the results of a test. And my mother was like kind of a famous professor and very well-loved and incredibly busy. And she was really like paralyzed waiting for the results of this test. And it made me realize how much that waiting matters and how hard it is for people. So I think before I had that experience, while I was a very busy resident working literally 100 hours a week, if I were, you know, if I had a CAT scan that I had to go give the results to a patient and family and I was hungry, I might say, oh, I'm going to go grab a really quick bite to eat and then give the results of this test. But after having that experience, I remember thinking, I can wait 20 minutes to eat. You know, these people are really desperate for the results of this. And, you know, I think it's unfortunate that I had to experience that in my own life in order to realize how much people are depending on our kind of respect for their time and their experience of what they're going through. But, you know, I think in healthcare, what can seem like just kind of a busy day and sort of one of many interactions, it could be for them like the crisis of their life. So just having that frame shift of this person deserves my full attention and this person, I have to sort of tailor the way I communicate and the way I care to the needs of this person.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. And it's often in healthcare, we do get a lot of those little jobs that we think, oh, I'll just squeeze this in here. It'll be quick. It'll be straightforward. I'll just tell them. But as you say, it's allowing the respect for that situation and the respect for that interaction, because while it's small and it's something that you do need to squeeze in somewhere into your very busy day, it's a really important piece of information and a really important interaction for that family and for that person as well. And kind of the way that you deliver it changes how they're going to feel over the next couple of days, even if it's the same kind of clinical information that you're putting forward.
Right. And having that perspective of just thinking for even a minute or a few seconds before having the interaction, what they might be going through will change how I approach them. So I remember once when my mom was waiting for the results of a test, saying, she said, I called this doctor, you know, three times in the last 24 hours. And I mean, why aren't they calling me back? I have cancer. And I said, Mom, your doctor is an oncologist. Everyone who calls them has cancer. But to her, you know, she wasn't really thinking it that way. And, you know, to the oncologist, like, that's all of their interactions all day long. But, you know, I think in your line of work, I mean, you might think if you're burnt out or callous or overworked, you might kind of think of an injury as minor or just kind of, this is my day in and day out. But for that individual, it could be their entire quality of life or even their identity of not being able to do something that really matters to them. So I think, you know, the part of the art of what we do is finding ways to, even when we are burnt out or even when we're busy or even when we're exhausted, finding ways, even if it means taking time off, to regain that sense of perspective and how much that matters to that person.
Yeah. And I think it's, as you say, a lot of these health problems that people have, whether it's an injury or whether it's cancer or whether it's something else, are a real threat to people's identities. They're a threat to the identity of a mother or a breadwinner or a son or a father or a teammate. And it's really easy for us just to look at the pathology and not as at the person as a whole and their life and what this thing that seems small to us actually means to them in the context of their life. And I think for those of us who have spent time as patients or have had family members spending time as patients and been in that experience and understood that, okay, there are a whole lot of emotions tied up within this, it gives us a little bit of inside running, I think, in regards to being able to put that into perspective. Although if you've got a busy day, it doesn't always happen. For those people that maybe haven't been through that an experience like that, is there a way for them to garner that perspective, do you think?
I mean, yes, and I'll share some strategies I can think of, but I mean, I think life experience is probably a better lesson than anything we can teach. And I kind of have maybe this cynical view that in general, people don't really care about an issue unless it affects them personally.
I would agree with that. There's a lot of stuff I don't care about.
But even things that, you know, you might think you care about because you're a really good person and because based on your values, you know, I'm not sure we would really go to great lengths to kind of fight for the civil rights of whatever that community is, unless it's affecting you or someone you love. Mm. So I do feel like there's nothing quite like life experience and watching your mom or someone you really love being affected by approach to healthcare or whatever they're in. But there are strategies. So for example, I think, you know, just even getting outside of your main day-to-day work and having a chance to communicate with patients or family members who have been through something, reading stories. I mean, actually, storytelling is probably the most compelling way that humans learn and remember anything. So stories are why we care about anything. And so I think by using story, either through the way we teach and have come, you know, even filtered into lectures or even in kind of large format presentations, we can use story to help people remember a concept and make them care. But I've also used, I've interviewed a lot of patients and family members about their experience in our critical care units. And I use short clips of these videos. Our interns have to watch them as part of a required course that I run in the beginning of their ICU rotation. So they actually have a patient in front of them on a video saying what it's like for them when the entire team walks in on rounds, or examples of times when people tried to use humor and got it totally wrong, or examples of times that people did things that really helped them feel trust or helped them feel really cared for. So that's one way, is to actually help provide people who have been through these experiences sharing their stories. And then you can use other exercises like reflective writing. So when I teach communication, sometimes I'll have the group say, okay, here's a case, you know, say this is a 75-year-old man with really bad emphysema, so a smoking-related lung injury, who is in the hospital now with breathing problems, respiratory failure, and has to go on a breathing machine and come up to the intensive care unit. So they're going to be thinking about that from the perspective of a first-year doctor who just finished medical school, and they're going to be thinking about, okay, what data do I need to serve this patient? How do I concisely explain this to the next doctor or nurse that I'm passing the care over to? And I say, pretend for a second that you didn't go to med school and this is your grandfather. Because of course, most of the students are like 25 or 20, you know, in their mid to late 20s. What do you think your family, if this is your grandfather, you know, what do you think you would want from this doctor, from the nurse at this point? What do you think you would like to hear? What kinds of things would you be afraid of? And what, you know, so I help them kind of have a mindset shift so that, because all of a sudden, instead of thinking, if I had said in the beginning, well, what do you want to hear from, they'll say, well, what sedation are they on? And what antibiotics are they using? And, you know, they have all these sort of informational questions. When I shifted to, this is your grandfather, what do you think your family needs to hear? They're going to say, they usually do say, I want to feel trust that he's in a good place, that they really care about him, that they are going to do the best that they can to help him, that we know that we have their support, you know, things like that. So I think there are strategies and conversations like this that, you know, help emphasize without having to go through it yourself, you know, hearing these kinds of stories.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And an exercise that I use with people is kind of writing a case study and writing it from a clinical perspective to start with, but then asking them to flip it over and write it from the patient perspective. Like, what is the patient going through with each of these points that you have made? The words around non-compliance or non-adherence, mm-hmm. like what's going on for them that has led to that? What's going on that they're not taking all of their diabetes medication, mm-hmm. or they're not doing those things that you asked them to do? And contrasting those two perspectives, because the clinical information is really important, obviously, probably more so in your setting than it is in a rehab setting at times. But again, just shifting that perspective and reframing the conversation around, okay, how am I looking at this problem? Because like as health professionals, we're trained to look at a problem one way. We're trained to look at it from that scientific approach. And this is what has happened in through our degrees. It happens mostly in our postgraduate training, and it's often the conversations that we have with our peers and our colleagues in the hallways as well, because that's the language that we use and that's the viewpoint that we look at that problem from. We start to get probably quite tunnel vision in our ability to look at those problems. So it's flipping them around and seeing them from a from another person's angle, and like you might not be able to step into their shoes fully and see it exactly from the way they're looking at it, but you can definitely get closer to it, I think, than where you start from.
Yes, Chris Desmond, I'm going to borrow that exercise. I really love that idea. I think that having having my trainees go through the exercise of writing a clinical course or hospital course of a complicated patient from their perspective, and then flipping it around and saying, what if you were this patient who just spent 3 weeks in the hospital? How would you write it from their perspective? Mm. I love that.
Yeah, good, good. I'm glad you're going to use that one. Laura, I'm going to switch it up a little bit. Emotions are a wee bit scary for us, I think, as health professionals, because we don't get much training in dealing with them. But why else do you think emotions are scary for us and we try to maybe avoid some of those emotional conversations?
I think one of the major reasons is time. I think that we all have this perception, or I'm going to say misperception, that if we address emotions, we're going to get stuck in a 45-minute conversation when we have 3 minutes to talk. Mm. So I think it's a combination of not being trained to manage to respond to emotion and not having the confidence to do that well. And also because of that, feeling like it's always going to lead to a really long conversation that you're going to get stuck in, and then you won't get your other work done. I think as humans, we are constantly dealing with this ancient battle of toggling between this human need for connection and our need to get work done, to get stuff done, not work. I mean, it could be at home, like, you know, you, yeah. So, you know, you need to get out the door with your, you said you have a 3-year-old.
Yeah. Yeah. And okay, so he's not the most logical.
Most 3-year-olds are not.
No.
I'd be worried if he was. So, you know, you have to get out the door for some important family event and he won't get his shoes on. Will not. And you're like, get your shoes on. And, you know, maybe it's, I mean, I don't know, that might not be the best example, but sometimes I think even taking a few seconds to kind of connect and help that person feel seen, even if it's a 3-year-old or if it's a patient or a colleague or a student, it actually can make you more efficient. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, we tend to, I mean, we've seen emotion generally suppressed. I think that's what's often modeled for us in healthcare. And really excellent research on emotional suppression has demonstrated that not only does it cause stress to the person who is having the emotion, but it even actually triggers this cardiovascular sort of physiologic stress response in the person who's suppressing their own emotion, or that they're suppressing an emotional response. So it actually causes stress on both sides and makes the person feel unheard, and it's a missed opportunity.
So yeah, I was going to ask you about that cardiovascular response as well, because that was really fascinating when you read that. And I didn't realize that I can understand how it would work in the person who's having the response suppressed, but from the suppressor as well, was really fascinating to see their physiological response too.
Yeah, it was an experimental study led by James Gross, which was capturing that phenomenon. So I think that the sort of big picture to me of why it's so important to respond to emotion is, well, two main reasons. One is that when emotion is really intense, it's very hard to process information, participate, and really feel like in a place where you can use your whole brain and reason and think. So part of it is that we have to help bring in the emotion to a sort of lower level of intensity so people can participate. And the other main reason is because often there's important values or concerns underlying the emotion that if we're quick to sort of reassure or provide information or just kind of have a surface response to the emotion that we're confronting, then we're missing an opportunity to better understand what those values are. And they may be important relational values or, you know, important kind of core issues inside a person, but they also may be important clinical values or clinical concerns. So, you know, one of the examples I think I gave in that paper was if a patient says, I'm really scared about having this procedure. Was this one of the examples? If the clinician says, oh, don't worry, this your surgeon's great. They do 400 of these a year. The complication rate is low. I might be missing, you know, instead of saying, huh, I can hear you're expressing, you know, you're scared. I get that. Procedures are scary. You know, tell me what's worrying you. Then I might find out that their brother had atrial fibrillation or in an abnormal heart rhythm when they went in for a procedure, or that the last time they had a procedure, they had a syncopal event and fainted. And so there may actually be clinical concerns that I'm missing by just kind of brushing their fear under the rug.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, putting my rehab hat on, how am I going to cope with going home after having this done? Like, I'm not going to be able to do anything for 6 weeks. How am I going to get my shopping and sometimes kind of looping other professions in there as well is really, really helpful.
Yeah. But sometimes, I mean, I think getting back to the issue of time, you know, when we have this bias that, oh, if I go anywhere near the emotion, I'm going to be stuck here for 45 minutes. Often their concerns are very brief. Like often patients, if they say, I'm super stressed, I'm just not okay. And you say, well, what are you stressed about? And they'll say, who's going to feed my cat while I'm in here? You know, or how am I going to tell my kids about, you know, what's going on with me? They don't even know about this diagnosis. So those are both things that, like, you could bring in a social worker to help with. You know, you can use your resources once you know what the problem is. That was a few seconds of interaction, and now you can actually help them with what's bothering them. So I think it actually does make us more efficient as a team and help the person feel cared for.
Definitely. And one of the things I always tell the new clinicians that I get to work with is that if someone's crying with you, it's a good thing. One, because it means they trust you enough to cry in front of you. So you've built some trust there, but also it means that you're talking about shit that's important as well. So you don't need to make everyone cry, but I think not being scared of someone crying while you're with them and trying to just kind of sidle backwards out of the room is really, really valuable. And I think also from our perspective, acknowledging that potentially we're adding to someone's emotional load as well, because like it's really easy to just kind of get wrapped up in the day-to-day of our work, and we're in a safe environment because we come here all of the time, but this environment is quite scary for people as well. So I think understanding our role in that emotional load is hopefully also going to kind of allow us to approach those emotional conversations when we need to have them.
Yeah, I totally agree with you that when people are willing to express their emotion, it is a gift. It's a sign. It may be a sign that they trust you. Maybe they cried at the person next to them on the bus.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I think, you know, taking that opportunity to just have some allyship, to sort of offer your presence, even if you don't exactly know the right words to say, just being there.
Yeah. And I'd love actually to just take a moment now to talk about the GIVE framework as well, because that's a really, really helpful one for healthcare professionals. Mostly love processes and frameworks. So like having that there just in the back of your mind when you're entering these interactions, I think is going to be helpful for a lot of people. So could you explain it, please, Laura?
Sure. So I have to qualify what I'm saying by telling you that I normally really hate acronyms and mnemonics because I just don't have the brain for that, and I tend not to remember them. And I remember in med school, you know, or in college, people would have all these, you know, funny ways of remembering some long, difficult thing. That was really never my path. But the reason why I'm biased that I like my acronym is because if the only thing you take away is that when you recognize emotion, you give, it's enough. Like you actually don't really need to know all the steps. I do think that while you're learning a new strategy or a new communication tool, it's really helpful to have some scripting. And so I will share the acronym with you. So the G is get that this is emotion and that it's important. So for example, if your colleague says to you, I've worked the last four Saturdays and I feel like I'm really kind of losing it. I can't do this anymore. And your response is, okay, I'll work your next Saturday. I mean, that's lovely, but there may be actually something really more important going on. So just knowing when to recognize, get that there is emotion here and it might require a different, not so automated response. The I is identify, which may be actually recognizing the emotion and naming it, like identifying it out loud, that it may be, it's often an internal step, like, oh, I'm really noticing that this person is writing every single word that I say down in this little notebook. And to me, that's kind of a sign of maybe some emotion going on. Or it may be saying something out loud, like that, the behavior that you're identifying, like, hey, Chris, I'm noticing that you're much quieter than normal today. Do you want to talk about it? The V is validate, which you do by acknowledging the emotion. This is not a normalized, like, oh, don't worry, everybody's scared that, you know, they have to go to kindergarten. But it's really like, I hear you're scared. And you might validate by, if it's honest, you can actually connect with the emotion too. Like, I would be frustrated in your situation too. It's hard to have that much uncertainty. And then the E is explore. So one of my favorite phrases is just tell me more, but it could be more specific about that emotion. Like I'm hearing you say, you know, you're scared about having this procedure. Tell me what's scaring you. So I think, you know, this is sort of the antidote to answering feelings with facts. And an example of the whole kind of interaction might be, you know, I'll give you a clinical example. So if say your father is in the hospital with septic shock, is it okay if I?
Yeah, go for it. Yeah. Okay. He doesn't listen to this podcast.
What's that?
He doesn't listen to this podcast, so it's fine.
Oh, well, I didn't mean your father. I meant more about like, will your listeners know what septic shock is?
Yeah. They can Google it if they don't.
Okay. So bad infection. And say they have really bad infection that spread to the whole body and they came into the hospital and it kind of overwhelmed the body. And now I, as the clinician, am saying to this patient's son, I'm really sorry to tell you this, but the antibiotics have failed to turn this around. He's getting sicker and just that, you know, the antibiotics aren't working. So, well, actually, first I'll ask you, how would you say, if you're going to answer feelings with information, how would you answer that? If I said, if you're the clinician, I say if the patient's son says, well, take a different antibiotic. I mean, there's a lot of antibiotics, just find another one. Obviously, you know, there's got to be another treatment.
As a clinician, then it would, with facts, empathy keeps trying to creep into my head.
Okay, I'll tell you. I mean, and it's not your field of expertise, so I'm being unfair, but a very typical response in the hospital would be, well, we ran a lot of tests and we know that the antibiotics that your father was on were the right antibiotics for this particular bacteria. Or even, well, we got an infectious disease consultation and they agreed that the antibiotic that we chose is the right, you know, no, there's no other antibiotic. So that's answering the question. Like they asked a question, can you change to another antibiotic? But it's missing the emotion. So what emotion is present? And if I'm like, come on, find another antibiotic. Of course there's a treatment.
Yeah, it's fear.
Yeah, there's fear, there's uncertainty, there's overwhelm, there's mostly fear. But so if I were going to do give instead, it would be like, I can hear this is a really terrible thing to hear. And I can imagine how scary that is. You know, it's normal to be scared with this kind of information. And I just want to know, like, is there anything I can do to support you right now? Or is there any, you know, tell me how are you hearing this? Where do we go from here? Maybe that's not the best example, but it's, you know, it's a very common response in a hospital to respond with information or data.
Yeah. And like, as you said, it only takes a minute to do that and connect with this person so that you can, one, help them process it, but also kind of deepen your understanding of, hey, is there anything else that I can do here?
I just want to clarify something that I did. It's not that information is never useful. Like, you may need to tell this person why the switching antibiotics isn't going to help. But if you go there first, they're probably not going to be able to process what you're saying.
Yeah.
And you're missing an opportunity again to connect and build trust. So if instead I say, I can imagine this is really hard to hear. This must be scary. So that's like identify, validate. And instead of explore there, I might say, you know, would it help for me to explain about the antibiotics? So it's not like I'm avoiding the question, but I'm recognizing that there's emotion there too.
Yeah. And I think with that identification and validation as well, that helps reduce people's levels of overwhelm. I mean, the research shows actually if we can identify an emotion or help a person identify an emotion, actually it's a lot more helpful for them to be assist them to manage it as well. I think what's the NAF saying? It's if you can name it, then you can tame it.
Which is
not great in this example, but it's maybe kind of helpful for people to remember.
I think it's great.
And I think I'm not a 25-year-old male anymore. I would like to hope that my emotional range is slightly larger than
emotion about that. Should I address the emotion you might have about
No, I'm okay with that. But I'm just saying that the example was that my emotional range is maybe slightly larger than it was when I was 25. Happy, hungry, angry, those kind of things, sleepy. And one thing that I've actually found helpful, like utilizing your framework with some younger clinicians and even some older clinicians as well, is putting up an emotional wheel as well and running through some scenarios and saying, okay, cool. What emotion out of all of these 64 do you reckon this person might be feeling? And I've actually, some people have kind of taken that away and put the emotional wheel up on the wall of their room. And so that they can utilize it as a talking point for some of the patients that come in with them, which is quite cool.
Yeah, I like that. I think that I just lost my train of thought while you were thinking about the emotional wheel. I think that when we allow ourselves to recognize this element of a conversation, we can often think back on conversations that didn't go well. So I'm actually curious, Chris, if you can think of one, but when I teach communication, I always start with, you know, tell me about your worst conversation in the last week or some encounter that really went wrong or that you're dreading having. And then we unpack it. And then by doing that, it almost always involves some emotion that was not addressed or that was missed or that was somehow just kind of either handled poorly or just ignored. And it's a really great way to sort of better understand an interaction that didn't really work.
Yeah. Actually, I've got one. Obviously, it's been a couple of months since I worked clinically, but I had one of the junior staff members came to see me and said, hey, can you have a talk with this lady with the shoulder injury about going to see a specialist? Because she's quite keen to. And so I got the history from him. And then it was a phone call, actually. It wasn't an in-person one, which sometimes is a little bit harder to gauge emotion. Mm-hmm. So I had a conversation with her and I kind of talked her through the process of going to see specialists and kind of the different avenues that we could go down and what the funding options would be for that. And it was about a 15-minute conversation. And afterwards I was like, cool. Yeah, I think I nailed that. And the junior staff member was like, yeah, okay, cool. That was really, really helpful actually hearing all of the process stuff. And then she called up and she said, can you make sure that I don't come and see that guy when I come into the clinic next time?
Wow.
Because I hadn't asked enough questions and I hadn't found out what was important to her and I hadn't found out why she wanted to go and see a specialist. And so she felt that I was kind of overbearing and trying to force her into doing something, which definitely wasn't my intent, but potentially the way that I communicated that and the approach that I took of the delivery of information didn't address her emotions and didn't address her needs at all. And where I thought I'd had a good conversation, and from a process perspective, it was a good conversation, but it could have been a shorter conversation if I'd asked her questions to start.
First of all, I want to really commend you on sharing that story, because I think it can be really hard to share our own kind of failures. So I think especially for your community of listeners, that it's such a great teaching tool to model your own vulnerability, but also model your mistakes and how, you know, you were able to reflect back or even debrief with someone and learn and, you know, have it inform your future moves.
Thank you. I've spent a little bit of time processing it. I used it as one of my reflective moments for my annual audit.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's amazing how even regardless of emotion, just asking questions, we do so little of that. So another style of speech other than give that I use a lot, which is very popular in the communication literature. I didn't write it. It's called ask, tell, ask. Have you heard this?
Yeah, I think so.
So it's frequently taught in medical schools. It's probably also taught in physical therapy, nursing, and other healthcare educational programs. And the idea is with ask, tell, ask is anytime you have to share information, you're going to start with a question, and it's going to help you be more efficient with how to share the information or just kind of understand what their needs are. Then you're going to share information very concisely and do this kind of chunk and check style of like just a little bit of information and check what they're kind of taking away from that. And then the second ask of the ask, tell, ask is to sort of check in about how it landed on them, what they're taking away, how you can be supportive to them. And I remember, I mean, it really is such an efficient style of caring. Once after my mother had a major abdominal surgery, this nutritionist came in to talk to her, and she just terrified her with this like 30-minute lecture about all the things she couldn't eat anymore and what would happen to her if she ate these things like a Big Mac and fries or, you know, steak tartare and, you know, hollandaise sauce or whatever. And if she had just said, so what's your usual diet? My mother would have said, oh, steamed kale and, you know, chicken with a side of raspberries. They'd be like, okay, keep eating that. Bye.
Yeah. You know?
Because my mother never ate all those things that she scared her about, but it did make her sad, feeling like now she's this damaged person who couldn't eat those things, even if she didn't want them. And so it really scared her. And it also was really time consuming and not helpful because it didn't at all address her needs. So I think just getting in the habit of saying, so just so I know where to begin, you know, do you remember why we ordered this test? Or, you know, what did the last therapist tell you? Just so kind of we're all on the same page. So, you know, I just think it's very respectful to start almost anything with a question, to offer that, like you're sharing the agenda and sharing the sort of ownership of where this conversation goes.
Yeah, exactly. And Laura, I mean, some of the things that you're working on at the moment is actually effective communication within teams as well. Why is that interesting you at the moment?
Well, a couple of reasons. I've given a lot of talks on communication with patients and families. At one point in this talk that I gave about trust, I asked this question where I just gave an example of different styles of hearing a response to a question. So I'd say something like, say you're talking to a colleague and you say, I really blew it. I had a terrible day. I think I blew it with a patient today. So here are five possible responses you could hear. And I want you to really think about these different responses. And this is, I would do this in my, even in a really, really big presentation with, you know, hundreds of people, to just use it as an exercise for people to really experience different styles of responses. So then I'd very slowly offer, oh, I'm sure it was fine. Don't worry about it. Two could be, well, my day was even worse. Three could be, you know, maybe you should get another job. Four could be, oh, let's go out drinking, you know? And five might be, that sounds really hard. It stinks to have a day like that. You want to talk about it. And, you know, out of this hour talk, this was the thing that most people would come up to me to, that was really resonating for the audience, that people would come up to me to talk about and say, everyone does these one through four. And it's just so common in our speech. And it just, it feels so bad because you just don't feel heard. And it made me realize, like, we're not talking about the way we're answering patients and families. We're talking about ourselves. And the reason why I used that in the talk was because I felt like if they could experience it for themselves, then I would turn it into a clinical question. A patient saying, I'm really scared about having this procedure. And the clinician says, oh, don't worry, your doctor has done 400 of these this past year. You know, oh, you're at Harvard, you're in really good hands. Yeah, don't worry, you'll be back on your feet. And, you know, or maybe you shouldn't have the procedure, or, you know, there's just no real effort to connect. So that was one reason that really kind of made me think about how I needed to shift communication to not just thinking about how we talk to patients and families, but really to how we talk to each other. The main thing, though, is that I've realized that, you know, when I teach about trust or how we connect with patients and families, it's really hard for patients to trust us and to connect with us when they perceive a lack of trust among the team. So patients have told me that when they see a doctor and a nurse arguing, not arguing, you know, productively in their interest, but really when they sense hostility between people on their care team or between, you know, different specialists, it's terrifying to them because they feel that if these people can't communicate with each other well, if they don't respect each other, then they can't collaborate to help me and they can't communicate with each other to help me. And they find conflict among the team terrifying. And so I think that, you know, when a patient and family member is very sensitive to a feeling of disrespect or just a lack of trust among team members. And I think it's a huge factor in our own joy, in our work, in our own learning. And I mean, this is well documented that, you know, learning matter, the mindset and the atmosphere of psychological safety really matters for patient care, but also for learning and certainly for joy. And so I really started thinking about how to change the way we communicate and support each other on teams. I've worked for over 10 years with the Center for Medical Simulation, and I've done a lot of work in teaching using clinical simulation and also teaching faculty, including physical therapists, who want to use simulation as an educational tool. And I love that work, but I don't think we're going to change the world fast enough by bringing everybody into sim centers. So I really like to take the tools that we're using when we debrief a simulated case into the clinical environment. So the beauty of simulation is you have a pre-brief where you establish psychological safety in it and in a really productive learning environment. You can have a great case that's really tailored to the needs of the learners. And then you have a debriefing where you can really share perspectives among different professions and different people. And so what I try to do is take those tools and bring them into a clinical environment. And what we're doing now that's, I think, kind of novel is a lot of places are getting into, have even for many years, tried to debrief after a crisis or an important clinical event, either a code, a cardiac arrest, or a really complicated handoff, or something that went wrong. What I'm trying to do is actually debrief daily, because I think that there are a lot of, although there's a lot to learn from debriefing a crisis, it's often the case that emotions are very intense. So it's really hard to get into a mindset to have sort of a calmer perspective sharing conversation. And also when we deal with a cardiac arrest, it often takes us away from all of our other patients for an hour or two. So we're pretty busy to get back to all those patients we've been abandoning while we're caring for this one really unstable patient. So I think, and also, you know, when we debrief, sometimes people feel like we're debriefing because I did something wrong, feel nervous or judged about going into a debriefing. So when we debrief routinely and they know we're doing this every day at 4 o'clock, it doesn't matter what's going on in the unit. It has nothing to do with anything that you did, good or bad. And we're just going to take some time to talk and try to learn from our day and just kind of connect as a team and support each other. It's a real shift in how the team connects and communicates.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing that as well. And it's always great as a podcaster when you don't need to ask any questions, when people just talk so excitedly.
I'm talking too much.
No, that's good when you're that excited about it, because obviously you're seeing great things happening from the changes that you're making.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't been able to finish this publication yet, but I'm working on it now. And just going through the data that we have from interviewing the people, the participants, and the data from what they actually said during the debriefings, it's really fun to see how it affected them.
Yeah, awesome. Laura, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been really, really cool to have a conversation with you. If people are interested in connecting with you or reading the stuff that you're doing, is there a place that they can do that, or what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, I don't really have a single place that captures everything. I'm not, I don't know, famous or organized. But first of all, I wanted to acknowledge a resource that isn't mine, but where I did some training that I think is really influential to me, and it's free. It's called vitaltalk.org. So Bob Arnold is one of the founders and leaders in that organization, and he was a really wonderful mentor to me. And Tony Back and James Tulsky and others have created this incredible organization that promotes effective and empathic communication skills for anyone in healthcare. And they, when I trained with them, that was really sort of where I got started on thinking about how important it is to connect with emotion rather than just answering kind of cognitive sounding questions. Mm-hmm. So anyone interested in that, I think should check out vitaltalk.org. And then for my work, I mean, I think if you Google me, you might find.
Yeah, there's lots of stuff on Google.
Maybe I can send you a few articles.
I'll link some of your articles up in the notes for this episode. That is a wrap. Thanks everyone for tuning into the show. If you've enjoyed it, then make sure to hit subscribe on your favorite podcast app so you don't miss any of the weekly episodes. If you want to support the show, the best thing you can do is to share this out with a mate that you reckon might enjoy it. And if you want to enhance your skills in this area even more, then watch out for the Art of Healthcare community coming in August 2021. It's a truly interdisciplinary space for us to upskill our art. If you want a sneak peek, for more info, head over to artofhealthcare.mn.co. That's artofhealthcare.mn.co. And a couple of quick thank yous. First of all, thank you to my brother Jeremy Desmond for the amazing theme music. And thank you to you guys for joining me as we look to improve our art.